This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, organic chemicals are concentrating in the breast milk of Eskimo women. They're put in the atmosphere thousands of miles away and are used in pesticides and manufacturing. Are red maples taking over northeastern forests? If so, why? Scientists disagree. Irrigation in the Northwest has created new rest areas for migrating sandhill cranes. And on the Earth calendar, organically grown cucumbers are being picked in Southern California. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Eskimo and Inuit natives of the Alaskan and Canadian Arctic are accumulating persistent organic pollutants known as POPs in their bodies, even though the sources of those chemicals are thousands of miles away in Mexico, southern Canada, the lower 48 states, and Russia. POPs include DDT, PCBs, and many other pesticides and industrial chemicals. Arctic native peoples are exposed to greater concentrations than populations far to the south, since the chemicals move north in the atmosphere and come to rest in cold places where they no longer volatilize through the warmth of the sun. Also, the chemicals bioaccumulate, which means they're retained by whatever eats them. Thus, a polar bear carries all the POPs that were in the fish it ate, which in turn are laden with the POPs in the organisms that fed the fish in the first place. Sheila Watklusi is the Canadian head of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. She explains why POPs are a particular concern to her people. Her native language is Inuttitut. Since most of our listeners have not mastered Inuttitut, I asked her to continue in English.
Well, what has happened is that these persistent organic pollutants have come from far away and have ended up in the Arctic sink. And as a result of that, have ended up in the food chain, our food chain. We are avid eaters of what we call country food, and country food being fish, caribou, a lot of marine mammals. And that's where the problem lies with especially our marine mammals such as seal and whale.
Scientists say the impact of POPs on human beings are not fully understood. But much of the data that has been accumulated is disturbing.
And it is starting to show up in many tests of mother's breast milk, in fetus growth and so on, that there could be long-term effects to this kind of pollutants ending up in our food chain and as a result in our bodies, and particularly with our children, anything from playing havoc with the long-term effects of intellect and so on with our children, with what you call the endocrine disruption. Immune systems, lowering of immune systems. There are many effects that could be happening.
Coping with POPs contamination in the Arctic raises difficult questions. Mike Bradley, epidemiologist for the Alaska Native Health Board, located in Anchorage, Alaska, says 40% of the calories consumed by Alaska Natives come from natural food. He's involved in research efforts to help determine how people should deal with POPs.
What we're trying to do is to find out just exactly what those effects may be, and we're studying different groups, primarily infants and mothers, to see if we can detect subtle effects from low-level exposure to these agents. One of the problems we get into is that traditional diets are very, very, very healthy. And the problem is that if people are concerned about contaminants in food, they may not eat as much traditional food, which we believe could be a mistake. So what we want to try and do is really find out what is in food, if there is a potential problem, and if there is, maybe to make some recommendations about what people may want to eat, may not want to eat, and levels that they can eat, and still use traditional foods, which again are very, very healthy.
To make the scientific puzzle even more complicated, Dr. Bradley says some natural foods also contain substances which help combat toxic chemicals.
One unique situation here in Alaska is that we think that some of these foods, like for example, foods that have selenium, may actually be protective against some of these things like mercury. So much of the research around the world somewhat applies to Alaska, but there may be other factors here in Alaska.
Dealing with POPs in the Arctic emphasizes the conflict between Western science and native knowledge. The observations of subsistence hunters and fishers on the land are significant, but perhaps not quantifiable in Western scientific terms. Nevertheless, the EPA has funded a project to gather native observations. Amy Craver is research associate for the Alaska Native Science Commission and has been interviewing elders in Alaska about environmental change.
People are noticing that, especially the subsistence animals that they're hunting, that there's a lot of abnormalities that people are noticing in the fish that they're catching, in the caribou and reindeer and moose, that they don't remember noticing before.
A global effort to take POPs out of the environment is now underway. Delegates from over 100 nations have been meeting under the auspices of the United Nations Environment Program to produce an international treaty which would ban or limit POPs discharges into the environment. Sheila Watkluski has been a participant. She wants a strong, enforceable, and verifiable convention.
It would be designed to hopefully, first of all, stop the processing of some of these contaminants and pollutants that end up. And then I think what its real plan to do is to help developing countries find alternatives, first of all, because we understand fully the struggles that other developing countries are having, in the sense that many of them are trying desperately to survive for themselves. The industry is important for many of them, as well as the pest control to save their own children. Malaria, for example, is a major cause of issue. Well, but we're saying is that the mothers of the world, the Inuit mothers of the Arctic and the Mexican mothers, for example, should not be the ones that are having to tackle this kind of issue. And we're hoping that the governments will be very open to creating a strong convention.
Further negotiations on a POPs convention are scheduled, and the process is supposed to be completed by the end of the year 2000. If you've ever seen a red maple tree, you know what a beautiful species it is. Its bright red spring colors give way to scarlet, purple, and gold hues in the fall. More and more, red maples are popping up in many parts of the country today. And one forest ecologist goes so far as to say they could literally take over forests of the eastern United States. But as the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports, this theory is not taking root with some tree experts.
We're talking about a tree that can totally change the character of the eastern forest. This is why I think it's such a big story.
Mark Abrams is professor of forest ecology at Penn State University.
Well, that's the really amazing thing about red maple is that it's increasing almost throughout the entire eastern deciduous forest. And this includes large areas of New England, the Lake States, the Midwest, the Mid-Atlantic region, and even part of the Southeast.
Red maples are a native species that traditionally were found in wet or swampy areas. Prior to European settlement, Native Americans used fire as a means of clearing land and regenerating growth. But as more settlers came, Native customs died out. Professor Abrams says the lack of fire is changing eastern forests of the United States.
We had a lot of fire in the history of the eastern forest, and red maple, having a relatively thin bark and being fairly shallow rooted, is quite sensitive to fire. And it is my belief that the recurring fire in the eastern forest up until about 1900 kept red maple in the wet and swampy areas where the fire would not get to. And then when we started to suppress fire in the eastern U.S. about 1900, this is called the Smokey the Bear syndrome, this has allowed red maple to move out of the swamps and invade most of our upland forests.
Besides fire suppression, Professor Abrams says there are other factors contributing to the increase of red maples. Historically, parts of the eastern forests have been dominated by oak and pine species. Professor Abrams says deer tend to eat more oak seedlings compared with red maple, which means there is a greater number of red maple trees that can take root. Abrams believes this change in the forests may not only affect flora, but fauna as well.
The acorns and the seeds that are produced by things like hickories and oaks and walnuts are very, very important for many bird species and small mammal and deer. And the loss of these mast-producing species, as we call it, I believe is going to have a dramatic impact on the population size of certain bird species and mammal species that depend on this mast. And we don't know whether these species can survive just eating the red maple seeds.
Some insects lay eggs on trees with rough bark. Red maples have a relatively smooth bark, which leaves Professor Abrams wondering whether this will adversely affect insect populations and the birds that prey on them. But not everyone agrees with Professor Abrams' assessment of the rise of red maples in the eastern forests.
Red maple is not taking over the eastern United States. That's really an exaggeration.
Dr. Don Leopold is distinguished teaching professor at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse. He is a dendrologist, someone who studies trees.
There's certainly a lot more of it today than there was 200 years ago, but that story's very similar to dozens of other tree species around the eastern United States, tree species which are much more abundant today. And 200 years ago were probably some of our rarest trees, but because of land use changes are now some of our most common trees. Red maple is just one of many that has undergone that big change in abundance.
Dr. Leopold says there are more important issues facing trees in the eastern United States, such as the problem of invasive species.
We have, over the last 50-100 years, brought a lot of trees into the eastern United States to serve as shade trees, lawn trees, urban trees. Norway maple is a good example. About a quarter of a lot of street trees throughout communities of the east are actually Norway maple. Beautiful tree, but it produces a tremendous number of seeds every year, and those seeds will enter natural stands of forest. And because Norway maple is one of the most shade-tolerant trees in the east, those trees can actually outcompete, can get rid of the native trees and shrubs that are very important for wildlife habitat and for aesthetic purposes. It's no small matter what's happening. This is becoming a very serious concern throughout the eastern United States.
One thing is certain, and that is that forests are constantly evolving, and only time will tell whether the red maple evolves into a dominant tree in the eastern forests of the United States. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We welcome three new stations who join the more than 200 now carrying the Environment Show. They're WPBZ-FM in West Palm Beach, Florida, KWAB-AM in Boulder, Colorado, and KZNZ-FM in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, www.hemmings.com. We want our new listeners and everybody to know that we expect to hear from you. Our comment line is 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. If what you say makes sense, we might broadcast it. If not, we might broadcast it anyway. Virtually every action by humankind affects the planet. Development is one of those activities that can help some species and at the same time hurt others. In Washington State, the creation of a dam has created a symbiotic relationship between farmers and lesser sandhill cranes. For one community, the arrival of the birds every spring has become a time for celebration. Nancy Wilson reports.
In the mid-1970s, the small town of Othello, Washington, began receiving irrigation water from Columbia River's Grand Coulee Dam. The massive amounts of water enabled them to grow a wide variety of crops, from corn, sugar beets, and potatoes, to alfalfa and wheat. With a stable population of about 3,000 people, other than a recently acquired McDonald's, it didn't look like things were going to change much around these parts. But in the late 70s, 25,000 sandhill cranes began descending upon Othello's fields and pastures. The cranes are migrants of Alaska and Siberia and stop off during their spring and fall migrations to feed on crop residue. Now, hundreds of people from all walks of life are migrating to this tiny town to celebrate the arrival of this large flying bird here at the second annual Sandhill Crane Festival.
Well, I'm Jackie Alkier. This is my husband, Ted. We're from Spokane, and we saw the Sandhill Crane Festival advertised in the paper.
Are you birders?
Not really. I've just wanted to see them.
David Miller's family grows Killian corn here in the Columbia River Basin. They make it into popcorn being sold to crane watchers today. I asked him if he was an Othello native.
Actually, I'm the outsider. I married my wife is born and raised here in Othello. They families had dairy farms and farms here for 40, 50 years.
Do they still have dairy farms? Or
We've got an uncle that still has a dairy farm. My father-in-law sold his farm about 15 years ago. And now works in this full-time.
Doing the popcorn?
Yes.
So as far as the Sandhill Crane Festival, is that bringing a lot of, fame or recognition to the area?
I think so. I've talked to several people here today who have come from as far as Olympia, you know, to come and view the wildlife in the area.
There are six subspecies of sandhill cranes worldwide. The 25,000 annual migrants to Othello are mostly lesser sandhill cranes. But Washington has 16 resident pairs of greater sandhill cranes, which are listed as state endangered. Randy Hill is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He believes the festival helps foster appreciation for the visiting cranes and...
I think mainly it's appreciation for the birds that are here. And also it may add a little appreciation to the local farming situation because the cranes are pretty much dependent on the farming.
Sandhill cranes have survived on Earth 60 million years. Their bones have been found next to dinosaur fossils. Sandhill cranes mate for life and usually lay only two eggs. When the chicks hatch, they immediately fight for dominance, a battle in which one usually perishes. One of the most interesting behaviors of the sandhill crane is its mating dance. Many ancient cultures admired the bird's movements so much that they incorporated them into their own dances. A local author here at the festival wrote about the sandhill crane in her book, Young Julius the Dancing Crane. It's opened a lot of people's eyes to these birds, like Nicole Garza.
Well, it's about this young Julius crane, and he talks about when he's in the egg and when he gets out, you know, how he breaks out of the egg type thing. And he meets this other girl crane and really likes her a lot and ends up doing a dance for her, kind of like a mating kind of dance for her, and they talks about them flying around, you know, just a lot of, to me, it gives a lot of detail, which is really interesting, because I didn't know cranes dance until I read the book, and I was like, wow, you know, I even learned something just from reading this little story coloring book type thing. It was just really, really kind of like a little love story for, you know, like Cinderella is what I thought of, you know.
With urban growth a looming threat to farmers who are struggling to survive, Othello residents like Terry Piper, who's a member of the Central Basin Audubon Society, are working to educate the public about the crane's habitat needs.
You have to be careful of development, excessive development. When people are doing things around water areas, they have to be careful that they're not impinging on the wetlands and destroying wetlands. A lot of people won't even know that they're destroying the wetland. They don't mean to. So they have to know that that's important. other things, education is very important. We work with kids groups, do a lot, take kids on field trips to the Columbia National Wildlife Refuge. We have other things where we have a habitat that we have developed at a local grade school.
20 years ago, irrigation brought sandhill cranes to Othello, and a surprising love has developed between the cranes and the farmers, like Irvella Hayford.
I think it's beneficial both to the bird people and to the farmers to have a better understanding of both the protection, environment, and food supply.
Now, this might be a dumb question, but do you have cranes on your field right now?
We have had lots, and they circle over our place every day.
But you hate to see them go?
We enjoy them. I enjoy them. They get used to us, and we're real gentle with them is the way we move around them, and they're not afraid of us, and I enjoy them very much.
Currently, sandhill cranes number well over 500,000. As irrigation water became available, greater numbers of sandhill cranes have become visible. It's a case where the influence of man has helped a species. But while the Cooley Dam on the Columbia River has helped sandhill cranes by providing water to farms in central Washington, salmon populations have suffered, one of the many trade-offs that come with human development. For the Environment Show, I'm Nancy Wilson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, cucumbers are being picked in Southern California. It's part of a great American harvest. Scott Mason is general manager of the Palma Valley Organics, a 110-acre organic farm located north and east of San Diego, California. He says a six-man crew picks the 20 acres of cucumbers by hand.
We try to get them about 8 inches long, 8 to 10 inches long. And we pack them 36 cucumbers to a box. We can field pack them, and they look clean. So we don't have to pick them, bring them in, wash them, and then pack them. So we're not handling them more than once.
Scott says most of his organically grown cukes are sold to brokers or co-ops, with a very small percentage going to local health food stores. Mason suffered a setback this year when an early frost destroyed 8 acres. Fortunately, he was able to quickly replant those areas which had been lost. The growing process begins in February, when the seeds are started in greenhouses. Then they're transplanted outdoors by the second week of March.
And we get the ground ready before that. We put about 5 to 15 tons of compost down per acre. And then we put 3 tons of composted chicken manure down, incorporate that into the beds that we make. And then we've also found, so we can field pack, we lay down plastic mulch that we plant the cucumbers into. And what that does, that helps the cucumbers from getting muddy from the watering from the, you know, when we irrigate. And it also helps with the weed control.
Because the cucumbers are grown organically, no chemicals are used.
Organic farming, there's a lot more to it than just the dollars. It's helping the soil, the ground, healthier food, helping the planet. Sustainable agriculture has got to be the way to go if we want to save this planet. And I think that people are starting to see that trend. I would like to see in the future nothing but organically grown produce. It's so much healthier for your children.
Scott describes his business as excellent. And he believes the organic industry will continue to expand as people become better educated about the food they eat. While some organic supermarkets are beginning to sell more organic produce, Scott says consumers who prefer organics need to tell retailers they should be allocating more space. Some organic cucumbers become organic pickles. some of us get pickled, but organic whiskey is hard to come by. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, you have heard of the ancient forests of giant redwoods and fir trees. But forests of kelp of similar size grow in the oceans off California and around the world. They form some of the most productive ecosystems anywhere. We talk green about environmental stress and conflict. Do wars start when the environment gets bad enough? Author Gary Ferguson takes us to the Red Desert of Utah, where the ghosts of ancient peyote peoples and their gods taunt adolescents who have ghosts of their own. Stay with us. Picture yourself sitting on a sandy beach in San Diego, California. As you gaze across the Pacific waters, you see a sailboat, a surfer catching a wave, and a seagull looking for its next meal. What you can't see, though, are large, lush forests that lie beneath the blue coastal waters. They're giant kelp forests that run from Baja California north to Santa Cruz. Next to coral reefs, kelp forests are some of the most productive ocean ecosystems in the world. But as Stephen Westcott reports, human and natural forces are putting pressures on these biologically important areas.
Kelp is the largest of the seaweeds. It's a brown alga which forms extensive forests on rocky bottoms off the west coast of the United States and some other areas of the world as well. And it grows from depths of, oh, say, 8 meters out to 25 meters and grows all the way up to the surface, and then once it reaches the surface, spreads out and forms a surface canopy.
Mia Tegner, research marine ecologist at Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, California, has studied kelp forests for the past 25 years. They are found all over the world, from the United Kingdom and Scandinavia to China, New Zealand, and Australia. Tegner says the kelp forests off California's coast are home to more than 1,200 species.
One of the reasons the kelp forests foster such high biodiversity is because of all the physical structure. The holdfast looks like a tangled root mass. More than 150 species of small animals, of sponges, crabs, copepods, and worms live in the holdfast. Other animals settle on the fronds of the kelp directly. Still, other animals like to use the kelp as something to orient in the water column. Fishes, for example, like to cluster near kelp forests.
By the 1950s and 60s, the dumping of sewage was disrupting these fragile ecosystems, and it wasn't until the 1980s that the problem was addressed. Mia says today, natural forces are having the biggest effect on California's kelp forests. Ocean upwelling normally brings colder waters that are rich in nutrients. The kelp and other species rely on the nutrients for food, health, and stability. But since the late 1970s, Tegner says there has been a decrease of La Nina events, which create cold waters in the Pacific, and an increase in El Ninos. Scientists say between 1951 and 1993, the average sea surface temperatures of California's coastal waters increased 2 to 3 degrees.
The warmer the water, the lower the nutrients. What El Ninos do is bring in warm water and depress the thermocline. The combination greatly reduces the nutrients available for kelps. As a result, the canopy deteriorates, and we can get considerable mortality of the plants themselves. So then all the animals that depend upon the plants, and here we're talking about fishes that shelter among the fronds, about snails and sea urchins and abalones that eat the kelp directly, about other species that use the kelp as a physical habitat. All of these species are affected by these oceanographic changes.
Tegner says the kelp forests are slowly recovering from the effects of the most recent El Nino, but adds scientists are not really sure why more El Nino events are occurring. Some theorize it may be due to global warming.
This change since 1977 may be a change that will flip back to cooler temperatures in a few years, or maybe we are looking at incipient indications of global warming. You know, it will take many decades to really know the answer to that, but if the warming that's going on is an indication of how things will change with global warming, we can say that they're going to be very harmful for nearshore productivity.
California's kelp forests are home to many fish species, such as rockfishes, kelp bass, and señoritas. A fish called the sheephead has been a favorite of commercial fishermen, who Tegner says have been taking too many. Sheephead are important because they feed on sea urchins, which live near the kelp forests, and can be harmful if their numbers are not kept in check.
When drift kelp becomes limiting for whatever reason, sea urchins will leave their reefs, their protected rock piles and ledges where they normally live, and go forage for food. And if they get hungry enough, they will attack attached plants, and they can mow through whole kelp forests this way.
Tegner and others are calling for tougher fishing restrictions along California's coasts to protect fish like the sheephead that are important to the health of giant kelp. Today, kelp is harvested for use in many common commercial items, such as toothpaste, beer, and pharmaceuticals. They're also favored areas for recreational divers and others who enjoy the beauty of these ocean ecosystems. But without proper management, Tegner says California's giant kelp forests will remain threatened. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be talking about the environment and why people go to war. Our focus will be on environmental stress and whether it leads to political instability. If it does, are we headed for more conflict as growing global population makes greater demands on resources like fisheries and forests and open space? Or do the forces that make people want to fight one another stem from ethnic and ideological conflicts unrelated to the environment? My two guests have thought a lot about this. Chris Bright is senior editor for World Watch magazine and research associate with the World Watch Institute. He's just published an article titled "The Nemesis Effect" that discusses stress and environmental degradation. He's in Washington. Also with us is Bill Futrell. He's president of the American Law Institute. I'm sorry, the Environmental Law Institute. It's a nonprofit group of lawyers and scholars who tackle international and local environmental legal issues. Bill has been involved in looking at the law and the environment for over three decades. So, Chris, from World Watch, let's start with you. Is political instability around the globe going to get worse as the global environment continues to deteriorate?
Well, you know, it's so difficult to respond in a very general way, but I would say that as various environmental stresses begin to accumulate, you see a sort of narrowing of the possibilities for maintaining political stability, especially, you know, in many areas of the developing world where things are already they're difficult for one reason or another. For instance, some population growth in some of the mega cities in the developing world, as those cities get larger, it seems to me the likelihood of instability is liable to increase.
Well, Bill Futrell from the Environmental Law Institute, I've heard you say that no matter how bad things get with respect to the environment, it's ethnic and ideological differences that drive people to take up arms against one another, and the environment really isn't a factor there.
Well, that's overstating my position. That's true in the 1990s. ELI's largest project this last year was on the environmental consequences of war. For a year and a half, we worked with scholars in the field and convened them at the Smithsonian Institution. And we really looked at this question of environmental stress and violent conflict in case histories. We looked into the case of Rwanda, and the most prominent writer on that was Thomas Homer Dixon, who felt that though environmental factors were significant development issues, that environmental scarcity had at most a limited aggravating role in the conflict between the Tutus and the Hutu. In another project done by the same Toronto think tank on Pakistan, he reached the same result. We view that environmental stress, rather than being the trigger for our conflict, is an opportunity for peace building. Currently, Ecuador and Peru have a disputed border that they have exchanged shots on. There's been armed conflict. But they are taking the disputed area and have entered into negotiations on an international park. We could come up with four or five other examples during the last 3 years where environmental stress has been the means for detente rather than the trigger for conflict.
Chris, your essay talks about a lot of environmental stress that we stagger into without realizing what was going on. I was particularly interested in what you had to say about the Danube, a river of some interest now since, as we speak, we're blowing the bridges off it one after another.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that and how that may relate to further stress in the Balkans.
Sure. Perhaps I should say, though, that most of my work hasn't really focused on the social issues. I don't think I would necessarily disagree with anything that the other guest has really said thus far. As far as the Danube is concerned, I was looking at how a number of stresses placed on the Danube and the Black Sea ecosystem tended to compound with one another and cause types of changes that probably no single one of those stresses would have caused by itself.
So, run those by us quickly, because that struck me as the classic example of what happens when you don't do decent environmental impact analysis before you start building projects.
Right. Okay. Well, there was a large dam that was set up on the Danube called the Iron Gates, which had the effect of reducing the amount of silicate that was being brought into the Black Sea.
Meaning sand, right?
Right. Yeah. Very, very tiny pieces of sand, and the effect of that was to cap the amount of algae, a certain type of algae that could grow in the Black Sea. And once those algae populations were suppressed to some degree, then we began to see other types of algae, competing types of algae, began to bloom. And some of these were red tide organisms, dinoflagellate red tide algae, which secrete potent toxins. In the early 1980s, there was an accidental release of a kind of jellyfish into the Black Sea, a jellyfish that is native to the Atlantic coast of the Americas. And the jellyfish had the effect, it underwent a sort of population explosion, and it ate all the little animals that normally prey on the algae. And this allowed the algae to sort of grow even more, the red tide organisms to become even more prominent. And that, of course, had an effect on the fisheries. The fisheries were already suffering from other unrelated stresses, overfishing and other types of pollution and so forth. So here you see a whole complex of pressures sort of convening on each other and creating an effect that you probably wouldn't have anticipated if you were just thinking of these pressures in isolation.
Well, let's look at that for a moment. Bill, one of the advances of American environmental law, which is now spilling elsewhere, is the now famous environmental impact statement required by NEPA. In theory, projects are supposed to undergo analysis so that they are fully understood. From an international perspective, is there any comparable process that comes to bear in places like the Balkans?
Through the banks. We did a great deal of legal assistance work in Eastern Europe after the Berlin Wall came down through foundation funding. And a lot of the work that we was doing were advising Hungarians, Poles, and Czechs on environmental impact assessment. Simply because EBRD, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, had the requirement for an environmental impact assessment on its loans. The World Bank has the same. However, Serbia, I don't think, is too interested in dealing with EBRD or with NATO.
And indeed, we've come a long way. When I was Environmental Commissioner of the State of New York more than 20 years ago, I had 40 people doing environmental impact analysis, and the World Bank, which was operating worldwide, had 4. So I guess the bank has come a ways. But let me ask you something. Once you do that analysis, particularly with respect to the bank, and I would suppose if it doesn't come out right, they might not fund something, does it really have an impact? Do people pay attention to this? Do the banks not fund projects today when it appears that the environmental impact may be disastrous?
There is a long process of jawboning and negotiations, and there is a very well-organized non-governmental organization, environmentalist organizations, groups here in Washington, D.C., that are constantly reviewing the bank's work. Mr. Wolfenson has elevated some of these people to positions inside. Now, the question is, the loan is probably going to go through, but projects are revised. The same as happens with highway construction in the United States. We all know highway designs that have been modified because of and even, you know, drop because of the impact analysis and public response.
I guess the question, though, is that with respect to the United States, if you turn the Department of Transportation around, nobody else is going to build the highway. We had a guest on the Environment Show not long ago that was doing environmental impact analysis for the World Bank in a project in Laos where a dam was being built. And one of the things that he said was that if the bank didn't finance it, then there were private sector organizations that were going to do it anyway, and they had no respect for the environment at all. Do we really have as much leverage on some of these big international projects by greening up people like the World Bank as we think we do?
Well, it's better to have the World Bank greened up than not greened up, and Three Gorges Dam is going forward without the World Bank money.
Chris, what are some of the areas where you saw integrated disasters occurring as a result of not having thought some of these things through first?
Well, they tend not to be disasters. They tend not to be quite so spectacular. There are a lot of places where you can see this sort of convergence. For instance, you can see it in global amphibian decline, as you probably know. All over the world, there are different species of frogs and toads that are either going extinct or that are experiencing a very drastic reduction in their populations, and this appears to be due, again, to a whole bunch of different pressures sort of coming together, pollution and disease and habitat loss and so forth. So we have things like that. We have things like the coincidence of certain types of pollution with the movement of these things are a little bit hard to describe very quickly, but with the movement of exotic species. For instance, in the Great Lakes, there's some evidence now that zebra mussels are beginning to resurrect some of the toxic organochlorine material that had settled into the muck there. And once the zebra mussels ingest this stuff, it can go back into the food web.
So I guess what it tells us is that much as Emerson said, we are in a spiritual kindergarten trying to spell God with the wrong blocks. These things are so complex that we're just not getting on top of them. Bill, from a legal standpoint and an international legal standpoint, is there any better way to do this than through environmental impact analysis? What kinds of things do we have to do to fine-tune our whole global system to avoid some of the real problems that we've gotten into by not understanding what we were doing?
Well, we need a lot of tools in our toolbox, and the environmental impact analysis is only one of them. The Nemesis Effect article that Chris wrote is a highly recommended reading, and the theme is very strong on the need for systems analysis, and a whole cat's cradle of strings are tied together here. And what we want to do is we want to intervene at many points. We're doing a lot of our work in India this year. And as I return each time from India, I think that it is not the poverty. It is the abject status of women in northern India and the refusal to educate women and to give them rights, especially in certain and really it's only in a minority of Indian states. That's one very important intervention point. Education, information, access to information are the tools.
Okay, on that, I'm afraid we have to close. My guests have been Chris Bright from the World Watch Institute and Bill Futrell from the Environmental Law Institute. And we've been talking about environmental stress and its impact on the world as a whole. We'd like to know what you think. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. We have some neat things on our website. You can answer a questionnaire and tell us what we really should be talking about. You can also hear the Environment Show. Go to our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Gary Ferguson, it's the red desert of Utah, where the beauty and craziness of today's youth parallels that of ancient myths. In this portrait of place, Ferguson reads from his book Shouting at the Sky, Troubled Teens, and the Promise of the Wild.
The middle of Utah's red desert 2, maybe 3 in the morning. Light from a full moon is spilling all over the place, down the shoulders of Caneville Reef, across the long, flat sweeps of sage and rabbit brush and greasewood, through a thin braid of dry, nameless washes, onto the faces of 7 teenage girls scattered across the ground at the edge of a box canyon, hoping for sleep. Lisa and Jenna are having weird dreams again, twitching and mumbling, setting off on what seem to be conversations, passing off a slur of words and grunts, even instructions. "Not that way," Jenna is saying. "Go left. It's over there." I'm trying to remember it all, give the words back to them in the morning on the off chance they might hold some kind of meaning. A few feet away, Nancy is poking Tricia in the ribs, trying to get her to stop snoring. And beyond that, under the only tree within a half mile, is the new girl, Brenda, the one who just went on suicide watch. Such a strange routine for her now, the drawstring taken from the hood of her sleeping bag, the laces pulled from her boots, just in case. A blue tarp spread tight across her bag, with 2 staff lying on the outside edges, one on either side of her, the better to feel every move she makes. So much craziness, and on one of the most beautiful nights I've ever seen. The kind of desert night that feels like a gift. Delicate, the air filled with a smell of juniper and sage, desert holly and cliff rose, sandstone and alkali dust. And out beyond camp, hundreds of sago lilies, 1 to a stem, their ivory blooms glowing in the wash of the moon. Lying awake through these wee hours, I'm thinking maybe all this wouldn't be so hard to get my head around, wouldn't seem so filled with contradiction, if my culture hadn't spent the last 100 years thinking of the wilderness mostly as some kind of tonic, sedative, blood pressure medicine, speed. The wilds as the place we go to smell the pine in the rain, dangle by ropes from the chins of mountains. It's been such a long time since deserts and woodlands were places of confrontation, stages on which to wrestle with shadows and cry for visions, holy lands hiding strengths that go unsuspected in more common hours. The old people of this place, the Paiute, knew full well that beauty and craziness would be found together like this, standing hand in hand. Paiute creation myth tells how long ago the earth was danced by 2 brothers, Coyote and Wolf. Wolf with his perfect, wholesome vision of the world, a creator who never wanted anything more than an abundant life for the people, a life free of anguish, free even of death. And the younger Coyote, spoiled, mischievous, the glib talker who time and again pulled his older brother away from those plans for perfection, and how after a time Wolf went away, leaving the world to unfold according to the imaginations of Coyote. "We cast our fate with Coyote," said the Paiute, "and so our lives are driven by this strange mix of urge and shadow, by schemes going out into the world meaning to be clever, coming back full of pain." Now these smudged, sweat-stained girls, kids who never knew of or cared a damn about the Paiute's brother gods, lying here in the shadows of these same ancient canyons, wrestling with Coyote things of their own, with their habits of crack and speed and crystal meth, with late-night trips to the police stations, to the streets, to the suicide wards, early in the afternoon with girlfriends at school, in the toilets, throwing up lunch.
That was author Gary Ferguson reading from his book, Shouting at the Sky, Troubled Teens and the Promise of the Wild. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you call 1-800-323-9262 and order show number 491, we'll send you a tape. How else can you go to Alaska, the New England forest, Washington for a crane migration, the cucumber patch, the ocean off California, and the desert of Utah all at once? No, we do not award frequent flyer miles. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, Ray Graff is post-production engineer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation. the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.